Welcome to the Reader's Roundtable edition of Cattlecast with Jessica Trotter, Mari Garza, and Cheryl Lindemann.
Welcome back to the Reader's Roundtable podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Jessica Trotter. I'm joined around the mic by Cheryl Lindemann and Mari Garza. Hey, hello. Ladies.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
We are going to talk books as normal, and we're going to talk a little bit about publishing and the year end and how's it going.
We've actually hit the year end. Remember when we first started talking about our reading goals?
Yeah.
And then, I don't know about you, but I had the mad scramble at the end of the year. I think I max checked out everything on my, max checked out to my card, what could be checked out, and I had piles all over my bedroom trying to figure out what can I read by the end of the year from this year. Because you know when the next year starts, you have these dreams of reading last year's books, but it's...
Yep, and sometimes you do get to go back to last year's books, but it's hard. It's hard because a whole new crew.
And it's particularly hard because we are on the front end picking the books and seeing them as they're coming in.
Right.
It is hard to kind of go back and pick up the older ones.
So what helps is if you keep hearing about them, like from other people or on blogs and things. Like, I knew I wanted to read that, and you get to go back to it. But
yeah,
I don't know. I'm still kind of feeling like my reading is not the same, but I think it's gotten better this year.
Mine is infinitely better this year.
Okay.
It was a broader range of stuff. It wasn't all comfort reads. Like last year really felt like it was 99%. I just need something to keep me sane reads versus branching out and reading broader, which is one of those goals.
Right.
And I feel like I did that better this year.
Good. I feel the opposite, actually.
It's funny.
I've read a lot. I probably read more this year than last year. I do that reading journal, and I looked at it, and so much of it was books that I didn't talk about on the podcast. I don't put in any book lists, just things that I read for personal reasons or that sort of thing. So it's been an interesting year, but still did do others, too. So I feel good about it, but there's so much that we can't read, which is one of our next topics to talk about, right? It's just... There was so much this year. We say that every year, but there was more this year physically than other years that we've
It certainly
gone together.
Feels that way. I can't imagine that not being actually the case. The number of titles that got pushed in out of 2020 into 2021.
Yeah.
I almost feel like as we're kind of seeing supply chain issues and things like that, it's sort of like a mix of I want to get all the 2020 stuff out, but I also want to get all this other stuff published before we have more supply chain issues and I can't get them published. I mean, it just so much actually really good stuff. Because if you look around at like the end of the year lists that are already out so far, it's such a breadth of really good titles. There's so much got released.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's hard because it means a lot of titles kind of haven't gotten... I think the marketing push that we really wanted to see for them.
Yeah. Yeah. That is part of what helps me, draw attention to a book and to really give it a second look if I haven't heard about it. So,
Yeah.
The marketing helps a lot.
Right. Yeah. And that's really hard with so many great books. I think we actually brought a few of them today. Some that you are going to see on end of year lists and a few that I know for sure I have one I'm looking at right now that I don't see. However, when it first came out, the publishing push was really, really hard, really great publicity, but it came out so early in the year that it's gotten lost in the shuffle. So seems like that's happened more than ever. And like Jessica said, the end of year lists, it's last year I felt like the end of year lists were pretty consistent. You know, there's always that outlier book. You're like, huh, interesting why they chose that. But this year it seems like it's kind of all over the map. I mean, a few things are clearly on all of them, but just this broad spread. And then some books that some more unusual titles, maybe a little bit narrower interest titles on some of the best year picks too, which is really interesting.
Yes. I mean, end of the year lists are always interesting in that you are definitely getting, I mean, they're so subjective.
Yeah.
Yes, you get that a bit of overlap in certain titles, but it is so interesting to see. I mean, it's a long tail of titles not overlapping
as
you start looking at these lists.
Yeah, even when we were compiling our own cattle staff list on that, the long tail was huge, and we could only put so many into the will come soon article about our picks for our from our staff.
So it is interesting. I would suggest people go and check out some of these lists because it's really fascinating. The one we were talking earlier and the one that matches up the best for me with my reading right now is actually NPR's Books We Love. It used to be the Book Concierge, but they've renamed it this
year. Yeah, I looked at that the other day. Yeah. That is a really nice list.
Did that match up with things that you had thought would be best picks?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. I would say so, although there were some titles there that I don't think I saw on other lists. So,
okay. Cool.
School Library Journal just had put out their best list, which I really, really liked.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Publishers Weekly put theirs out a while ago. I really
they were kind of the first
too.
Out and yeah. theirs are always the oddest I think for me
there's the Kirkus list which are interesting for nonfiction.
Yeah, what is always so often surprising is that you get a lot of books that were published late in the year and they're really not even out yet, and I'm like, how did this make the list? I mean, of course we all get to review books in advance, but I'm really excited about some of the ones that actually I haven't gotten a hold of yet or haven't been released yet because I want to
Yeah, and that's the other side of it. They do weight heavy toward the most recent releases. I feel like we as the collective don't go back far enough when we're looking at, you know, building these lists. And it's funny because even Cheryl and I have done a book talk for the Okemos Library recently. And even my kind of looking back and trying to figure out what came out this year, I found myself looking at it and thinking, oh, wow, that was still 2021. I thought that was last year for some of these titles. And it's sort of, it is interesting as you're going through.
It requires you to sort of go back and excavate a bit for sure.
Yes, definitely.
To make sure you're not missing those titles.
Obviously so many lists out there, and we'll put a couple in the notes for the podcast. Yeah. But one I think is fun to look back on. If you are on Twitter, there is an annual hashtag library libfaves, LIBFAVES. It'll be libfaves 2021 this year. They do it over the course of a week, or actually 10 days. It'll start December 8th, and then run, the librarians drop a title a day, and then they compile this giant, giant list. And what I predict for this year is that it's going to be the list with the longest tail of individual titles that we've ever seen. Because last year actually was like that. I think this year is going to be worse. But it's going to be a really big, neat list of favorite picks. So it's one of those ones that I love to point toward people towards.
Very cool. Well, I think I would like to get started with the first title. And this was a title that you are seeing on almost all of the lists. And it's a book that I wanted to read when I first heard about it. But that's another thing that we deal with, I think, the three of us, is getting to the books. You know, you get them and you have this huge stack and then you have to return them because there's a huge list on them, that sort of thing.
Yeah, this one's been on my TBR for the whole time as well.
Yeah. And it's, I think we even put this one out on an LSJ article as a read for a pick. So I wanted to get to it, and I finally did. It also just won the National Book Award, and I can absolutely see why. So this book is called All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley Sack, A Black Family Keepsake by Tia Miles. And Tia Miles is a Radcliffe professor of history. But she did spend a lot of time at the University of Michigan as a professor of history. And this book is a work of archival history. And it literally takes a historical artifact, a physical item, and then through research, through sort of tracing a trail, it fleshes out a full picture or story based on facts that she could find, but also based on art, memoirs, literature, and pulls together a full picture, some of it, you know, created from those other documents, but some created from what she found of the women's lives. And so the story here is that in the 1850s, a woman named Rose, who was enslaved in South Carolina, had a daughter named Ashley, a 9-year-old daughter. And at that time, children could be sold in slavery. And so Ashley was set to be sold. And she, at the last moment, or we don't know, we presume, gave her child the sack. And this was a cotton sack that was something, a possession that many enslaved people would have had access to. And this cotton sack was filled with items that Rose selected for her. And the book then goes through each type of item and talks about the history of that type of item and its relationship to enslaved people at the time. And then she, you know, talks about, each chapter sort of talks about that type of item. So this is what was written on the sack when it was found. This was an embroidered inscription. It said, "My great-grandmother Rose, mother of Ashley, gave her this sack when she was sold at 9 in South Carolina. It held a tattered dress, 3 handfuls of pecans, a braid of Rose's hair. Told her, it be filled with my love always. She never saw her again. Ashley is my grandmother, Ruth Middleton." So in this book, she then, the author Tia Miles, goes into the stories of Rose, Ashley, and Ruth, finding documents from Ruth's life. This is a powerful story. It's a somber story. It's an incredible work of scholarship. And I can't think of a more deserving book for the National Book Award this year. And I would like to promote that everybody read this book this mm-hmm. year. And if not this year, then next year. It's okay mm-hmm. to go back. So that's All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley Sack, A Black Family Keepsake by Tia Miles.
Okay. I've got a couple of graphic novels that I wanted to bring to the table. I think they're, again, it's those things that I've seen them on lists, both of them. One of them's getting a lot more promotion than the other, so I wanted to bring both of them. One is fiction, and that's the first one, which is The Ballad of Sophie. It's just, it's a beautiful story. It's sort of a three color. It's red, orange, red, orange, and grays are part of is the design. A young journalist arrives at the door of a world-renowned piano star for an interview that Julien Dubois does not intend to give. But something about the time or the reporter, or maybe it's his conscience, makes him settle in to tell his tale of anger, envy, and empty fame. Goes from pre-World War II when he was a child and his mother made him take music lessons and he didn't enjoy it and he didn't want to do it. But she wanted him to be concert level. She wanted him to win in performances and competitions. And it goes up through the era of disco when he's adapting his career to the times. It's beautifully drawn, a kind of a score with movements for each period of his life. It includes adapting a cat. It includes the caretaker or housekeeper that he lives with. And then this last inquisitive guest who wants to know his story. It blurs the lines of fantasy and reality. When he's talking about his childhood, he remembers his mother making a deal with the devil. That's how he, and she, the reporter is like, I mean, is that really what happened? It's like, that's how I remember it.
Wow.
but it's just, it's a, and there's more to the story and there's more to the reporter and he has somebody he's competing with his entire life. But it's not it's whether or not it's a real competition or a fulfilling competition or whether the envy is appropriate or not. It's just a beautifully drawn, told story.
Wow.
And then totally on the opposite end of the spectrum, I have Seek You, A Journey Through American Loneliness by Kristen Radke. This is particularly appropriate in the time of a pandemic, but this is a sociological study begun in 2016 with no pandemic in sight. Radke sort of dives into the concept of loneliness. She talks about our cultural history. She intersperses it with memories of moments of isolation. She explores what causes loneliness, how it manifests, how it affects us. There aren't a whole lot of studies, but one of the things that they have found out is that loneliness is contagious. Wow. As you isolate in your loneliness, the people who actually are there for you that you're not recognizing start to do the same because they feel cut off from you. Mm. And it can go out about 3 degrees in that terms, as wow. In terms
wow.
of spreading.
That's very striking.
And
wow.
she, you know, she talks about trying to combat the, you know, the consequences of that for with individuals, with communities, with societies. She defines loneliness as the resting in space between the relationships you have and the relationships you want. Mm. And it's just, it's really, yeah. No, it's actually, it's really well done. And it's
sounds
really,
well hits it right on the nail.
It's kind of eye-opening. And she looks at things like, you know, laugh tracks, the oh. addition of laugh tracks to things, or things that we do, she talks about, and this is unfortunately appropriate for the time, but she talks about the way the media presents things, the idea of a lone shooter, that mm-hmm. you know, the way, you know, the way we promote that lone hero in terms of, oh, Jack Reacher, or mm-hmm. the cowboy, the lone cowboy who yeah. comes into town, and what was, you know, we promote it in some ways and are terrified of it in others. It's yeah. It's a fascinating study.
Sounds great.
And it's a graphic. It is a graphic illustrated memoir. She is an illustrator. So
I saw it looks a little bit into Robert Putnam Bowling Alone and that sort of thing too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's,
yep.
sounds really
yep.
good. Wow, what a, that sounds like a really good work of nonfiction in the
yeah.
graphic format.
Exactly.
Very cool.
Exactly that.
Wow. Well, the two books I have, in a way, remind me of, you know, the loneliness that a lot of immigrants feel when they come to this country as adults, you know, the language barriers, the cultural differences. And, you know, I think children, thankfully, are very resilient if they get part of their growing up experience. When they come to a new country, they get the opportunity to assimilate. But for a lot of adults, it's very, very difficult. And I've heard of a lot of people who have spent, you know, in Dearborn 20 years and then decide to go back, even though their home country is still not that much better than when they came here, because they just never made that, you know, connection here in the U.S.
Right.
and just felt too much loneliness culturally and, you know, maybe individually the way you describe it. But the two books I want to talk about, one is a picture book. It's called Home is in Between. It is by Mitali Perkins. And it was immediately just like, wow to me in the first two spreads of the illustrations, because it's about a little girl. Her name is Shanti. And she says goodbye, you know, to her home village of Bangla in India, I think. And she's saying goodbye to her grandmother, and it's this very lush palm trees, tropical looking area. And immediately on the next pages, it's like a downtown scene from Pennsylvania or New England, sort of like downtown Mason, if you can picture that. You know, it's autumn, it's cold. So there's like just two very different sorts of places where mm-hmm. she's coming from, you know. So she goes from home in India to this new place in the U.S. where she's moved with her family. And, you know, I think that the story basically is a back and forth of like how she feels, you know, in between two cultures or two places that she considers home, because she's, you know, at home in her kitchen with her family, still speaking her native language, eating the same foods, dancing with her mother, all those things that sort of like bind her to her home culture. But at school, she's like learning all these new things and doing new things and, you know, trying to adapt to the traditions of American school children. But one of the themes that I really, you know, I'm not sure if this was supposed to be a central theme, but for me, it was like this idea of code switching, where, you know, from a linguistic point of view, Shanti is going back and forth between languages with her parent or her mother, really, in stores and things, trying to help them understand and how common that is for a lot of children. And you see it in doctor's offices, you know, stores and things mm-hmm. where you see children trying to help the parent mm-hmm. understand the English language or understand what the meaning that, you know, the doctor's trying to convey. I just thought it was really, really neat how children, like I said, I think they're really resilient when they come here and they face all these new things. And there's maybe a curiosity to them that maybe, you know, for adults isn't always present. I'm going to end my spiel about this book with something I thought was really funny. One of the spreads are like Skyping or, you know, video chatting with their family back home. And on the laptop, instead of an apple in the middle, there's a chili pepper. It was so cute. The other book that I would like to promote, I think this is a really interesting read, and I do hope people will consider reading it because it really gives you a picture for what it's like for kids, you know, especially if you come as an adolescent, to learn English and to try to understand. The title is Love in English, and it's by Maria E., I think, Andreu. It's not Andreu, but Andreu, A-N-D-R-E-U. And she herself is from Argentina. She spent part of her youth there. This is a romance comedy, sort of, about 16-year-old Anna. And she's moved to New Jersey from Argentina. And some of the things that you might want to know is that, you know, her father was selected for the diversity lottery visa program. If you don't know what that is, it's, you know, the U.S. government will issue something like 50,000 plus visas every year to help diversify our country. And not everyone from all countries can apply every year. There's like, I don't know what the criteria is, but they change the criteria for what people from what countries can apply. But something like 13 million, I think, applied for it in 2020. So her dad gets to come here. And so she's separated from him for like 3 years. So when she comes here, finally at age 16, he's like different. She's missed out on some of that. She's noticed that he's aging. He's more serious. He insists on everybody always speaking English all the time so that they can, you know, adapt and get the language right. But back to Anna, she's a teenager who I think is very hopeful and very optimistic. She's a poet. She's really trying hard to like figure it all out. And it's always funny because, you know, we often hear that people from around the world have these images or ideas of what they think the United States is like. You know, I have some of those ideas of what I think the United States is like, and I'm from here. And they don't always match up. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I appreciated that the author really gave a really good picture for what it's like for people hearing English. She, in the book, so if you can picture a hashtag or like that pound sign, you know, she's like, okay, it's math, you know, you're in math class and like, please take out your math books and then comma, pound sign, pound sign, pound sign, pound sign. And because we're going to pound sign, pound sign, understand? You just don't you don't understand that. What is being said. And wow. It kind of reminded me of like that teacher in the Peanuts.
Yes.
Blah, 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 blah. Exactly. You know, you're like, you just don't get what is being said. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of a love interest. She's got Neo, or short for Neo Phytos, I love that name, from her ESL class and her math class fellow student Harrison, which I just thought it was a really, really neat story. And I loved how Maria Andreu kind of gave a really good picture of what it's like for an adolescent to understand. And I'm just going to end with one of the chapter titles that totally laugh out loud. Can I spank your hoarder?
What? Okay.
Imagine hearing something like, what in the world? And just like, you understand all those words, but you just can't get what the context is. So, of course, you've misheard what the words are, but it's just funny, very funny.
So, all right. Excellent. So this home idea, our books really are coming together mm-hmm. thematically without us even really trying again. This idea of home and of movement and immigration really features in my book, my next book. This is the book that I was looking at earlier that I said got a lot of press in the beginning of the year, and then it sort of fell off the map, and I unfortunately, a bit. It's called In Bibi's Kitchen, The Recipes and Stories of Grandmothers from the 8 African Countries that Touch the Indian Ocean by Hawa Hassan with Julia Tertian. And Julia Tertian has written a number of really notable cookbooks, and she's friends with Hawa Hassan.
But Paula's own story matches up a little bit with what Mahdi was just talking about, because Hawa Hassan's family, they were Somali and refugees that moved to Kenya. And the circumstances were very dangerous, and her parents were able to get her to America, to the Seattle, Washington area. And she ended up being there in her high school years alone. Her family was not able to join her. She only joined up with her family years later in Norway. So that's part of her story. But one of the things that it talks about in the introduction in this book is that she really wants to present a picture of Somalia and of food and of her culture that isn't that sad story, that mm-hmm. isn't always that really heavy, sad story.
Right.
It's a story of resilience and joy and culture and family, and that comes through in these pages. So this book is arranged. It features 8 African countries that touch the Indian Ocean. All of the countries that speak Swahili in this book. And the word Bibi is grandmother in Swahili. So it's arranged by country. It gives a nice little country profile, talks a little bit history, language, just a few pages. And then it features some Bibis, some grandmothers from the country. Talks about where they live and also where they're from. So for Eritrea, the first person actually lives, I believe, in Ethiopia. So they live in different areas because of, unfortunately, fleeing, you know, situations. Some of them are refugees. Some of them are in the United States. But it shows them in their kitchens. These are not celebrities. They're not restaurateurs. This is not that kind of cookbook. But they all talk a little interview about family, about recipes, about the meaning of food in their lives. And the recipes and pictures are just gorgeous. And very accessible. These are recipes I think I'm going to make many of them. Lots of vegetarians, some meat, some really, really interesting ones. Like the Somalian recipes have an Italian influence because of, unfortunately, you know, the colonial rule of Italy in that area. So you can see the effects of colonialism in some of the food as well. But this is just a beautiful cookbook. I encourage anyone to check it out and pick this up and try some of these wonderful recipes and enjoy the stories of these women. And she talks about how books like this and you making this food is like carrying the torch of someone's life. And I really think that that comes through with this book. So you had a food one, right, Mahdi?
I do, actually. Mine is We Love Pizza, Everything You Want to Know About Your Number One Food. And this is by Elenia Beretta, published by Little Just Dalton, which publishes a lot of really cool kids nonfiction books. We know at Cattle, just based on our CIRC numbers, that kids love factoid books. you know, think of the National Geographic weird but true sorts of books, or the 1001 facts about dinosaurs you didn't know, or that sort of stuff. This book isn't quite like that, but it's very factoid based in that it gives you a little bit of history of pizza. I liked, you know, just learning little things. You know, Norwegians on average eat the most pizza per capita. I mean, you think, you know, you look at their population and how many pizzas are sold or what they buy. Detroit-style pizza, got to mention, which surprised me a little bit.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a pizza that's made with a certain type of cheese, Wisconsin brick cheese, and it. I think what makes it notable is it kind of, like, overflows the size or something like that. I didn't know these specific things about it, but the margarita pizza, which I actually didn't really come on my radar until I lived in Spain, I saw it like everywhere, and I'm like, how come I've never heard of this style of pizza? But it was named after a queen in Italy who a famous chef prepared something for her, and turns out that's the one she loved, and, you know, that's why they called it the margarita pizza, that's named after the queen. So it's just a really neat book. I think parents reading with their kids can really enjoy nonfiction together and can, you know, spark all sorts of different conversations for other types of foods or things that are, like, especially prominent in our culture. And I would definitely say pizza is,
it's
you
there.
Know,
yep.
all the time, no not question. Just, you know, at certain times of the year. I mean, there's football season and all that. But, yeah, so that's my
cool.
plug for a food book.
It's awesome.
Well, going back to food, actually, and going back to the book that you probably are seeing on every end of your list.
Yes.
I can safely say it.
It's Crying in H Mart, a memoir by Michelle Zauner. And I wanted to bring this today, even though you are probably seeing and hearing about it, maybe some of our listeners have already read it, but if you haven't, there's a reason it's on all the best of lists. This is a memoir by Michelle Zauner, who's the singer and guitarist of a music group called Japanese Breakfast. And she's in about her 30s, and it's a memoir about a really strong relationship with her mother. And she grows up in Eugene, Oregon. She's Korean-American. Her mother is Korean. Her father is not. She grows up in an area where she gets uncomfortable questions about being Korean, about being Korean-American. And she grows up in a really strong food culture with her mother. And her father loves it, too. They go to Korea. They visit relatives. They eat all this amazing food, which is explained in great detail in the book. And she has that really close relationship that an only child often has with their mother, extremely close when they're children. And then she hits her teens and her 20s, and the relationship starts to fissure. She has a lot of problems. Her mother is lovely, strong, but also overbearing, and that is a factor. And she's like, listen, I need to be myself. I'm not who you want me to be. I need to figure all this out. So the relationship gets strained. She goes off to college. She starts, pursuing her adult life and what she loves in life. And then she gets the call that her mother has stage 4 gastrointestinal cancer. And it throws her life into a complete tailspin. And there's also that uncomfortable, loving, intense, but uncomfortable relationship to reckon with. So she goes back and becomes a caregiver to her mother. She drops everything, and with some aunts, which is also sort of uncomfortable because the aunts are Korean. They know the language. They know the food. And she's in that other space as Korean-American. She's not always accepted. They're kind of pushing her aside. And she goes and begins this sort of difficult, painstaking process of caring for her mother and knowing that her mother is not getting better. They try chemo. They try different things. There's a very difficult trip back to Korea that they think is going to be something that's going to help. It doesn't, but it connects them with some of her relatives. So it's a lot about, reconciling that relationship of deep love with identity. It's very much about the healing and binding powers of food to ancestors, but also to a culture. And then it's just about, identity and having something really serious and horrible like this happen in those formative years. So just a beautiful book, Crying in H Mart by Michelle H Mart, which is a Korean grocery chain, by Michelle Zauner.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
So I'm jumping off for a couple of things on that. One of them is this is the one I heard a little bit about before it came out, but it's sort of dropped off people's radar and I want them to know about it. It's Clark and Division by Naomi Hirahara. Hirahara is a former Edgar winner, and this is her, and it's actually been a little while since I've seen something released by her, but this is a mystery set in 1944 Chicago, just as Japanese Americans are slowly being released from internment camps. Aki Ito and her family have been held at Manzanar relocation camp in California. The oldest daughter, Rose, was released early, settled in Chicago. The family is going to join her. It's a good day. They're finally getting out. But when they arrive in Chicago, they were met by a group of people telling them that Rose had died. She was hit by a train, and police are calling it suicide. Aki cannot believe that. That is so not her perfect... The sister she looked up to forever, the sister that took care of everybody, that is not, it doesn't compute, and she just can't let it go. So she starts investigating Rose's life and death in Chicago. And there's such a rich atmosphere of this book. So you've got the murder mystery on top, but underneath you've got the specter of the internment camps. You've got the fact that, yes, they're being, Japanese Americans are being released, but it doesn't mean they're getting everything back or anything back. They had a life in California. They're being relocated to cold Chicago. They're theoretically support services that are supposed to help them get started again, but nobody's going to, there are no jobs for Japanese men. Women seem to be able to get some kind of, you know, like cleaning or maybe some office work, depending on their level of education. But the racism is rampant at this point. But it's an interesting look at generational differences. So her parents are the immigrants. So Rosa and Aki were born in the United States. They have, you know, that mixed viewpoint that we've talked about more than once here. There's an interesting look at the plight of minorities in general, because you've got different minority groups in Chicago. You've got just the plain old corruption of Chicago is part of the story, because it is historic. But it's just, you've got quite a lot going on, and then you've got Chicago as a character as well. So it's a really well done story.
It sounds really good.
So that was Clark and Division by Naomi Hirahara.
Well, I have a couple of holiday books, maybe. Yep. But before I get into them, I am going to mention If I Were You by Lynn Austin. And this is actually an adult fiction title. It's one that I kind of like to, this author I like to recommend a little bit to teens who are interested in reading books with not a lot of sex in them, or that sort of storyline. And I would say that there's not much in this. It is a historical novel. Lynn Austin does a lot of historical novels. And you will know her because she's kind of a prolific, or definitely writes a lot of books.
Definitely, yes.
Inspirational Christian fiction author. And I read this book for my book group. And this story is set kind of starts in the 1930s, but goes into World War II and then in the 1950s. And it starts off really with one of them has decided to take the identity of the other one. These are two, they're not sisters, I'm sorry. One is upper class, one is lower class. It's kind of like that, I don't know if you remember Downton Abbey, below stairs, upstairs sort of thing. Mm-hmm. One of them is like the daughter of a servant who was working in this, you know, stately home. And then the other one is the daughter of the owners of that stately home. So they end up friends, and they're kind of friends on and off throughout their lifetime. You may have friendships like that in your life where you kind of keep running into each other, but you're not super close, but then maybe at times you are. But one of them at the, you know, they both end up having children or a child, and one decides to go to America to take on the identity of the other one, because the other one has a right to go to America due to her deceased American husband. And it kind of is a story about identity fraud in some ways, but also about like trying to grab at things that you really want for yourself, because you think that's like the picture perfect version of what you should have. Mm-hmm. I liked it because it had those, you know, historical World War II themes in there, which I often say, I'm like, that's it. I'm never going to read World War II again. I'm so sick of it. But I don't know why. I just really enjoy learning a little bit more every time, particularly about, you know, the role that women played in supporting the war and in helping to keep England safe. So this kind of jumps into my next title. It's called The Wish Book Christmas by Lynn Austin also. And this book is a little smaller than the one I just talked about, but it involves the two same characters who are now both in America. They've kind of resolved their differences. You know, one decided to go back to being who she really was, and then the other one decided to take her identity back. But they both have sons, and it's... Does anyone remember the wish books that you would often get in the catalogs? Yes. Yep. I'm certainly old enough to remember that there was not just a Sears book, there was a JCPenney book, and these like super thick books with just stuff that you could get and toys. So that's one of the themes in this book, and about the boys just really wanting that, you know, toy Christmas, and just themes of holiday, you know, giving, and what does that mean, and how can we kind of exercise, I don't know if self-control is the right word, but decide to say, I don't need to take all of this. So, the other title I have is The Golden Dreidel. And this is by Ellen Kushner. And wow, this was a really neat fantasy sort of book. It's kind of set in a modern day, I think. I mean, I couldn't tell that it was historical at all, but there's a child who, kind of in the beginning of the book, Sarah is like kind of lamenting the fact that she doesn't get to celebrate Christmas because she's Jewish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they go off to their family Hanukkah party, and there's this golden dreidel that she receives as a gift from this mysterious relative who appears. And this dreidel has like magical powers, like she's able to spin it, and it takes her in through the TV that they've just busted, and it's a really neat book. And I think as a person who is not Jewish, it helped me to understand a little bit more. I mean, I had to remind myself, like, what is this toy again, or this object, and what are the letters on it, what does it mean? It was really, really interesting. I think it has modern appeal. Most of the books that I see published about Hanukkah are like picture books. This was more of a chapter book, and really an interesting book that I would like to recommend to all readers.
Looks great.
I like Ellen Kushner. I haven't known about that one, so I have to look into it.
Is she write
sci-fi fantasy.
Really?
That's what I think of her as. She wrote Swords Point, and
I don't think there's anything like that.
There's definitely a fantastical element to it. And the other thing that I read, I didn't get a chance to research it much, is that it's loosely based on a play or a radio drama, maybe from a radio station in Boston.
Oh.
Maybe NPR. I don't know. I want to go back and look into that, because if there's a radio version, I would love to take a listen to it.
That's really cool. Well, moving from that, I have a children's book this year. Children's is not my selection area, but I can't help but read them. So I know
we all do. Yes.
Yeah.
No question. We all do.
Children's books are
picture books.
The most beautiful things. Yeah. So this was one that I picked up in the new section of one of our libraries, and it was by Bette Midler. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, you don't really just think of Bette Midler as a picture book author, but it's called The Tale of the Mandarin Duck, A Modern Fable. And I remember loving The Tale of the Mandarin Duck by Catherine Paterson, an older version of the actual folk tale. Well, this is truly a modern fable. It's just using the duck as a jump off. It doesn't really bear any relationship to the other tale. And the photographs are by Michiko Kakutani, who was a big book reviewer, New York Review of Books. But this story, it is just fantastic. It's a mix of drawn pictures and these gorgeous photographs of New York. And briefly, essentially establishes New York as this place where everybody communicates. They love to talk face-to-face. They go to museums. They go to restaurants. They enjoy the culture. They enjoy the parks. And then one day, everything changes because the phone, which was something that was on a cord or cordless in the home, is now in everybody's hand.
Oh.
And so we're all walking around, and now the city of excitement and connection is now everybody looking at their phones, walking down the street, and they have pictures of people at dinner together looking at their phones. Everywhere you go, everybody's looking at their phones.
It is dreadful. Oh, yeah. Man.
Everything changed, right? And so that's where we're at. Everybody's doing that. Life is going on. And then one day in Central Park, this Mandarin duck, and it's on the cover of the book here, a photograph of this gorgeous, if you haven't seen a Mandarin duck, look one up.
Really this colorful.
Gorgeous duck, yeah. It's not native to the U.S. It's not native to Central Park for sure. It shows up. And people see it in Central Park, and they start then bringing it to Twitter, you know, Facebook, taking photographs. Everybody's taking pictures. Everybody's taking videos. Everybody's posting it everywhere on social media. And then one boy stands up, and he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to look at this duck with my own two eyes. I'm just going to look at it. And then everybody, because it's a fable, is like, wow, what a great idea. So they start just looking at the duck, like staring at it. And it brings sort of some duck family members. It's really, really cool. And the pictures are in here. Okay, so they all start doing that. And they start talking with each other. And they go out to eat. And they talk about, did you see the duck in Central Park yet? Have you seen the Mandarin duck? Da, 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 da. And then one day it goes. It leaves. But about 6 months later, it leaves.
But the town, the impact of the duck is still there, and people are closer, and they're remembering that. It's okay to just not take a picture of whatever you're doing. Just do it. Just be there. Just talk. And so the duck has left its magic. And it's based on a true story, sadly not about the phones, I don't think, but more about the Central Park duck was a real duck, and it did take social media by storm. It was looked at all around the world. It's in 2018. It was there for about 6 months, and then it did disappear. And people try to figure out where it went, but they don't know. But it's just a lovely book, and I also learned through it that Bette Midler is really involved with conservation efforts, and I thought that was just an excellent book, and kid approved because my now almost 10-year-old child loved it and wanted it as a gift for Christmas. So that is also an endorsement of this very lovely book. All right.
Okay, I have one last one that has no bearing on anything we've just talked about. it is a historical novel. That's about as close as I can get to anything that we've discussed today. It's The Cut by John Wemlinger. This is a historical novel with a touch of romance, but it dramatizes a very real feud I had never heard of between the lumber companies and homesteaders in Manistee County, Michigan, in the early 1870s, early to late 1870s. The lumber company in the area had created a dam to power their mills, but the dam, by doing that, they're flooding the homesteaders' farmland. They went back and forth. They took legal action. The farmers actually won, and there was a cease and desist order, but it could never be served to the owner of the mill because the owner of the mill didn't live in Illinois. The owner of the mill lived in Illinois, not in Michigan, so they could never serve the paperwork, and it had to be served to the owner. So they were just stuck in a legal loop that meant that the sawmill could keep doing what they were doing. And in this is the whole backdrop of the story. In front, we've got Alvin, who is the son of a homesteader and a homesteader in his own right, and Lydia, who is the daughter of an engineer working with the lumber company and the railroad. And they bump into each other one day, and this romance starts and blooms. But you've got these two very angry groups, and Alvin in this particular... Alvin, it's fictionalized characters, but Alvin is trying to keep the homesteader's head school, and his father's actually kind of the hottest head of the bunch, one of the hottest heads of the bunch, and they, you know, trying to keep them from doing anything that will get them thrown in jail, because while they are legally in the right, anything they do would be illegal. What they decide on, when all else fails, is to create, basically cut a channel to relieve the pressure on the dam and thereby theoretically saving their farmland. What they don't plan on is that they have completely, the pressure from the dam is so much that they reroute the waters for that area and it floods out the sawmill. So the actual book opens with a Lake Michigan ferry going down and the captain has been asleep. And he's called up to the bridge to look around and realize that they are suddenly in a forest because all this loose lumber has flooded into Lake Michigan. And this simple cut is, I think, maybe 500 meters or something. I mean, this cut that really did happen rewrote the shipping and trading abilities of the communities on that little part of Lake Michigan. And this is a book supported by the Manistee County Historical Associations. It's really beautifully done. It actually continues the story. It talks a little bit about the couple and the other trials of that faced the area, because not too long after that was the Chicago Fire, and what a lot of people don't know is that actually affected a good chunk of West Michigan as the communities. The winds blew in, and fires started along Lake Michigan on the Michigan side as well. But the big fire was in Chicago.
Yeah, and also in Holland on the
yes,
same day.
Yes, exactly. So yes,
same
but
day,
Manistee
yep.
burned too.
Oh my gosh!
So it looks at a little period that I had family there in that area in that time. Wow. And it's just not stories that I had known. Mm-hmm. So it was a nice surprise to find and pick up and read. So
sounds awesome.
Just a Michigan story for, you know, people might not know about the West Michigan side. And it's really well done. And it's a cute romance. It's a nice romance. It's not graphic in any way whatsoever. And it follows the family a little bit through some of the trials. Wow. That continue, even up into touches on the pandemic as well.
Really?
Yeah, 1919.
Okay.
The flu pandemic.
Very interesting.
Wow. Well, that was good.
Okay, so there's a lot of books that I want to read now. Thanks, guys. I didn't need more on my list.
Yep.
Top of my list, though, I think is In Bibi's Kitchen, though I will always want to read. Yes, All That She Carried. Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah, thank you, everybody.
Really nice to talk books with you. We're hoping everybody has a wonderful holiday season, and we'll get back with you after the new year.
Yep. Happy reading.
Bye-bye.
Yep, happy reading.
Hey, it's Dee Dee in the Morning with Dee Dee's weekly download from Capital Area District Libraries. This week's title is The Son of Mr. Suleiman by Eric Jerome Dickey. This compelling novel is a wonderful example of the late author's work, with sharp commentary and sensual characters telling a complex and powerful story. To stream or download this or other featured titles, just visit cadl.org/Dee Dee.
Stacks 92.1.